you're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. Welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 22nd. I'm Eve from Drake University. Here is our first story. In the Iowa legislature, police support builds for bill. This proposal would regulate automated traffic cameras, and the picture is of a traffic camera, and traffic moves along West Broadway as a red light camera stands at the northeast corner of the intersection at 16th Street on February 26, 2021. Cedar Rapids' police chief joined other law enforcement officials in the state in advocating support for proposed legislation working its way through the House and Senate to regulate the use of automated traffic enforcement cameras across the state. A House subcommittee on Wednesday advanced a bill that would require Iowa cities to obtain approval from the Iowa Department of Transportation for the placement of speed cameras along interstates and highways. The DOT rolled out a policy a decade ago in 2014, but the Iowa Supreme Court ruled that the agency lacked the legal authority to regulate traffic cameras. The cities of Des Moines, Muscatine, and Cedar Rapids filed lawsuits in 2015, successfully challenging the DOT rules that prohibited cities from placing the systems on highways and interstates. The DOT had ordered some of those cameras turned off in 2015, sparking the lawsuit. Cedar Rapids Police Chief David Dostal joined police chiefs from Des Moines and Altoona on Wednesday in support of measures in the House and Senate to preserve, regulate, and standardize automated traffic enforcement across the state as an alternative to a separate effort that would ban their use. Cedar Rapids uses the cameras at 9 locations along its primary highway system, and major thoroughfares for both speed and red light enforcement, including 4 speed cameras near the S-curve on Interstate 380 near downtown. Dostal told lawmakers that the cameras have resulted in a significant reduction in serious injury crashes over the past 3 years. "There's a change in traffic behavior resulting in traffic safety," Dostal said. Lawmakers have attempted several times over the years to prohibit or regulate the use of the devices, citing concerns over their growing use, including in smaller communities, and that they're principally being used to generate revenue because of lack of funding. The devices capture video of vehicles speeding or running red lights. Law enforcement then reviews the images captured by a camera vendor and issues citations to the vehicle's registered owner. House Study Bill 740 advanced out of a 3-member subcommittee Wednesday with unanimous support. It moves next to the House Ways and Means Committee. Police chiefs urge regulation in lieu of ban. Iowa cities, including Cedar Rapids, Des Moines, and Davenport, see the cameras as traffic safety tools that reduce public safety costs, providing 24/7 traffic monitoring and enforcement at a significantly lower cost than deploying officers to those areas. That frees cities to focus strained resources elsewhere. The city of Cedar Rapids began using automated traffic enforcement in 2010. Speeding citations are issued for vehicles that exceed the posted speed limit by 12 miles per hour or more. On the second page of this story, we have a photo of traffic on US Highway 67 in the 2300 block of South Cody Road passes by a speed camera in LeClaire. It focuses on one car coming close to a speed camera on the side. Continuing with the story, revenues from traffic citations issued for violations captured by cameras often go to fund police departments. Cedar Rapids anticipates the cameras will generate $7.2 million in revenue for the fiscal year beginning July 1st and ending June 30th, 2025. Roughly $5.5 million of that amount is budgeted to fund 41 police officer positions. More than $1.7 million is earmarked for the city's traffic camera service provider and collection costs. Cedar Rapids partners with vendors Census Gatso USA Inc. to run their program. For red light citations, Census Gatso receives $22 per paid citation, and the city receives $78 per paid citation. For speed citations, the vendor receives $18 for a paid citation, and the amount of the city and the amount to the city varies depending on the amount of the fine. Dostal and law enforcement officials said they're willing to put guardrails on the use of traffic cameras to make sure they're used as intended for safety purposes, and support a regulatory structure that creates a reliable, standardized process. I appreciate having this conversation about a regulatory bill. It's long overdue, Des Moines Police Chief Dana Wingert said. There are jurisdictions out there that are not doing it the right way. Some that are not, but all of the things I see in this bill on the regulation side are things that we've already been doing, things that we've been doing since the inception. What the bill does. The bill codifies the previously adapted 2014 DOT rules. Cameras would only be allowed in areas with documented high crash or high risk locations that make it unsafe for police to make in-person traffic stops, such as the I-380 S-curve. Cities and counties would be required to apply to the Iowa DOT for permission to install a speed camera on a state highway or interstate, and justify the location with data showing a high volume of crashes, as well as documentation of alternative solutions tried and considered but not implemented, including engineering and design changes, and public education campaigns. The bill applies only to cameras used by local jurisdiction to monitor and enforce excessive speed violations on DOT-maintained primary road systems. The Iowa DOT would not have the authority to regulate traffic cameras that issue tickets for vehicles caught speeding or running lights on city streets. It would also prohibit the DOT from using automated traffic enforcement or receiving related payments from cities and counties. Cities and counties could appeal to the DOT denial of a traffic camera location and would be required to report back to the DOT annually on the number of citations issued and any change in crash volume to justify the continued need for a camera at approved sites. The bill requires stationary cameras to be calibrated quarterly and mobile systems calibrated before each use at a new location. Cities and counties would be required to post signs in advance of locations where traffic cameras are in use to alert drivers. It also states automated traffic enforcement cameras must be used in conjunction with conventional law enforcement methods, not as a replacement for law enforcement officer contact. Wingert suggested House lawmakers amend the bill to standardize fines across the state so that Iowa drivers know what to expect. Altoona Police Chief Greg Stallman, representing the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, also suggested including red light cameras, which are not addressed in the bill, and requiring a public information and education program to take place before cameras are used to issue warnings. Subcommittee Chairman Representative Phil Thompson, a Republican from Boone, said he is open to amending the bill to include these suggestions. Where the bill goes from here. The Senate has advanced its own bill to regulate the use of automated traffic enforcement cameras. Unlike Senate File 2408, the House bill does not specify how local governments must handle revenues from traffic tickets. The Senate bill would require communities to give up a share of revenues to the state for law enforcement training and an award program for volunteer firefighters and emergency medical personnel. Revenues kept by cities and counties could only be used to pay for road projects or to offset police or fire department operating costs. The Senate would also ban traffic cameras for communities under 20,000 in population and specifies how fines could be issued by larger communities. I fully expect us to marry language between the House and the Senate on a regulatory piece and move that forward, Subcommittee Chair Representative Phil Thompson said. Both chambers also introduced legislation this year that combined a traffic camera ban with another controversial bill that would ban the use of handheld phones or other devices behind the wheel. Senate File 2337 is on unfinished business in the Senate. A similar House bill failed to advance. I really think there's a middle ground here, Thompson said. I totally understand the perspective of people who want an all-out ban. But I'm honestly, philosophically, in that camp. But working with police chiefs, especially in the Cedar Rapids area, these can play a good role in public safety. So I think we're really striking a good middle ground here as far as making sure it is about public safety and not about revenue generation. Senator Mike Klemesh, a Republican from Spillville, the chair of the Senate Transportation Committee who proposed the Senate regulation bill, says he intends to sit down with House lawmakers in the coming days to hammer out the compromise language. I've always been pro-regulation and look forward to continue and work on that as it moves forward, see what kind of compromise we can come up with, Klemesh said. Our second story is titled Citizen Police Review Board Prohibition Bill Gets Blocked. Accompanying it is a picture of Council Bluffs Police Officer Tony Friend getting a cruiser ready to hit the streets for his shift on May 11th, 2023. Officer Friend is sitting in the police car and looking at a machine with a screen on it. Proposed legislation that would have banned citizen police review boards in Iowa will not become law this year, a key state lawmaker said Thursday at the Iowa Capitol. The proposed ban on the boards, previously passed by the Iowa Senate with bipartisan support, will not advance any further in the Iowa House, said State Representative John Dunwell, a Republican from Newton. Dunwell, who managed the bill in its early legislative steps in the Iowa House, said there are many unanswered questions about the bill and its potential impact, and the proposal needs more work. Because of that, he said the bill will not advance any further this year. With everything on our agenda, we felt it was a better time to wait, do some more work, make sure that we fully understand everything that's in the bill before we move forward, Dunwell said. Under the proposal, all citizen police review boards would have been banned in Iowa. Currently, 5 cities, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Coral View, University Heights, and Dubuque, have the boards. The city of Cedar Rapids did not formally register in support or opposed to the bill, despite requests from advocates for the city to oppose it. The city instead remaining undecided, according to state lobbying records. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell eventually told the Gazette that she favors keeping Cedar Rapids' board in place. I think it has worked really well in Cedar Rapids, O'Donnell said. I do believe it is a best practice. The bill, Senate File 2325, also would have made changes to city civil service commissions that oversee the testing, hiring, promotion, and discipline for police officers, firefighters, and other civil service positions. Representative Sammy Sheets, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, described the bill's death as a double-edged sword, because while he did not want the proposed ban on citizen police review boards, he did like the bill's provisions on civil service commissions. I think it's very good that places like Cedar Rapids that have a citizen review board that have built community trust have built stronger bonds between our community and the police force. I think that's critically important for cities across the state of Iowa to be able to have the ability to institute those boards, Sheets said. At the time, obviously any time there's legislation to protect public sector workers, as a union member and somebody who works for a public sector union, I think that would have been very good for Iowans to have, Sheets said, referring to the civil service positions. The bill, as originally written, only contained the civil service provisions. The proposed ban on police review boards was added later, during floor debate in the Senate. During that debate, Senator Scott Webster, a Republican from Bettendorf, criticized past discussions about policing policy by Iowa City's Community Police Review Board. Webster also asserted citizen review boards give no due process to a police officer at all, even though the Iowa City Board, according to the city's code, has only limited civil administrative review powers. Dunwell did not rule out further consideration of the bill during next year's legislative session. The makeup of the Iowa legislature will change to some degree with this fall's statewide elections. It's an important topic for all of those who have an interest in the conversation, Dunwell said. Whether you're someone who's concerned about police officers or firepersons, or someone who's got concerns from the community, it's important for all. So we want to make sure we do it right. Our next story is titled Congress Honors World War II Ghost Army. Group's mission was to fool the enemy using creative trickery tools. The photo is of House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, on the right side, presenting the World War II Ghost Army member Bernard Bluestein of Hoffman Estates, Illinois, with a Congressional Gold Medal during a ceremony Thursday on Capitol Hill in Washington. At left is fellow Ghost Army member Seymour Nussenbaum of Monroe Township, New Jersey, reporting from Dallas. With inflatable tanks, radio trickery, costume uniforms, and acting, the American military units that became known as the Ghost Army outwitted the enemy during World War II. Their mission was kept secret for decades, but on Thursday the group stepped out of the shadows as they were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal at a ceremony in Washington. The actions of the Ghost Army helped change the course of the war for thousands of Americans and Allied troops and contributed to the liberation of a contingent from a terrible evil, Secretary of the Army Christine Warmoth said during the ceremony at the U.S. Capitol. She said most of the techniques the Ghost Army pioneered are still used on the battlefield. Even though technology has changed quite a bit since 1944, our modern techniques build on a lot of what the Ghost Army did and what we are still learning from your legacy, she said. Three of the seven known surviving members attended the ceremony at the U.S. Capitol. Bernard Bluestein, 100, of Hoffman Estates, Illinois, John Christman, 99, of Leesburg, New Jersey, and Seymour Nussenbaum, 100, of Monroe Township, New Jersey. Nussenbaum, who grew up in New York City, was studying art at the Pratt Institute before he joined the Army. Eventually, he joined a unit specializing in camouflage that was part of the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops. Our mission was to fool the enemy, to put on a big act, said Nussenbaum, a painter who went on to a career in commercial art. It was like putting on a big production, he said in an interview before the ceremony. We have had, in some cases, people impersonating generals, putting on a general's uniform, and walking around the streets, he said. Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts said during the ceremony that the Ghost Army members were creative, original thinkers who used engineering, art, architecture, and advertising to wage battle with the enemy. Their weapons were unconventional, but their patriotism was unquestionable, he said. House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, said during the ceremony that an estimated 15,000 to 30,000 lives were saved because of the Ghost Army's work. The legislation to honor the military units with the Congressional Gold Medal, Congress's highest honor, was signed into law by President Joe Biden in 2022. That came after almost a decade of work by family members of the soldiers and Rick Bayer, a filmmaker and author who helped bring their story to light after their mission was declassified in 1996. Bayer, president of the Ghost Army Legacy Project, produced and directed the 2013 documentary The Ghost Army and co-authored the 2015 book The Ghost Army of World War II. They put themselves in harm's way, wielding imagination, bravado, and creativity in order that other soldiers might be able to fight and live, Bayer told those gathered Thursday. This is a day that has been a long time coming, but it has been well worth the wait, he said. The Ghost Army included about 1,100 soldiers in the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, which carried out about 20 battlefield deceptions in France, Luxembourg, Belgium, and Germany, and around 200 soldiers in the 3133rd Signal Company Special, which carried out two deceptions in Italy. One of the biggest missions, called Operation Viersen, came in March 1945, when the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops deception drew German units away from the point on the Rhine River, where the 9th Army was crossing. They had hundreds of inflatables set up, Bayer said in an interview before the ceremony. They had their sound trucks operating for multiple nights. They had other units attached to them. They had set up multiple phony headquarters and staffed them with officers who all pretended to be colonels. This was an all-hands-on-deck affair, and it was completely successful, Bayer said. It fooled the Germans. They moved their troops to the river opposite where the deception was. In September 1944, the Ghost Army helped fill a gap in General George Patton's line during an attack on the Germans in the French city of Metz. They end up holding this part of the line for 8 days, which is a really long time in terms of doing a deception, trying to keep up appearances, Bayer said. In Nation and World News, the Justice Department sues Apple. This story is from the Associated Press. Prosecutors allege it illegally monopolized the smartphone market. From Washington, the Justice Department announced a sweeping antitrust lawsuit Thursday against Apple, accusing the tech giant of engineering an illegal monopoly in smartphones that boxes out competitors, stifles innovation, and keeps prices artificially high. The lawsuit, filed in federal court in New Jersey, alleges that Apple has monopoly powers in the smartphone market and leverages control over the iPhone to engage in a broad, sustained, and illegal course of conduct. Apple has locked its consumers into the iPhone while locking its competitors out of the market, said Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco. Stalling the advancement of the very market it revolutionized, she said, it has smothered an entire industry. Apple called the lawsuit wrong on the facts of the law and said it will vigorously defend against it. The sweeping action takes aim at how Apple molds its technology and business relationships to extract more money from consumers, developers, content creators, artists, publishers, small businesses, and merchants, among others. That includes diminishing the functionality of non-Apple smartwatches, limiting access to contactless payment for third-party digital wallets, and refusing to allow its iMessage app to exchange encrypted messaging with competing platforms. It specifically seeks to stop Apple from undermining technologies that compete with its own apps, in areas including streaming, messaging, and digital payments, and prevent it from continuing to craft contracts with developers, accessory makers, and consumers that let it obtain, maintain, extend, or entrench a monopoly. The lawsuit, filed with 16 state attorney generals, is the latest example of aggressive antitrust law enforcement by a Justice Department, as taken on Amazon, Google, and other tech giants with the stated aim of making the digital universe more fair, innovative, and competitive. Antitrust researcher Dina Srinivasan, a Yale University fellow, compared the lawsuit's significance to the government's action against Microsoft a quarter century ago, in picking a tremendous fight with what has been the world's most prosperous company. It's really a big deal to go up and punch someone who is acting like a bully and pretending not to be a bully, she said. Our next world news story is Blinken. Rafa would be a mistake. U.S. House Speaker says he'll invite Netanyahu to speak to Congress. In the photo, an aircraft airdrops humanitarian aid Thursday over the northern Gaza Strip, seen from southern Israel. It shows a view upward at the sky of a plane and the relief packages, which are on parachutes. Reporting from Cairo, U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said Thursday a major Israeli ground assault on southern Gaza town of Rafah would be a mistake and unnecessary to defeating Hamas, underscoring the further sourcing of relations between the United States and Israel. Blinken, on his sixth urgent Mideast mission since the war began, spoke after huddling with top Arab diplomats in Cairo for discussions over efforts for a ceasefire and over ideas for Gaza's post-conflict future. He said an immediate, sustained ceasefire with the release of Israeli hostages held by Hamas was urgently needed, and that gaps were narrowing in indirect negotiations that U.S., Egypt, and Qatar have spent weeks mediating. Blinken will head to Israel on Friday to meet Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his war cabinet. The growing disagreements between Netanyahu and President Joe Biden over the war will likely overshadow the talks, particularly over Netanyahu's determination to launch a ground assault on Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians have sought refuge. Netanyahu has said that without an invasion of Rafah, Israel can't achieve its goal of destroying the Hamas militant group. Netanyahu, on a video call with GOP senators on Wednesday, pledged to ignore warnings about a Rafah operation. As Blinken and the Arab ministers met, Gaza's health ministry raised the territory's death toll to nearly 32,000 Palestinians since the war began in October. Meanwhile, House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican Louisiana, said Thursday he plans to invite Netanyahu to address Congress, a show of support from Republicans amid growing Democratic criticism of Netanyahu's leadership. Republicans have rallied around Netanyahu since Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, called for new elections in Israel on the Senate floor last week. Schumer, who is Jewish and a strong supporter of Israel, said he believes the prime minister has lost his way and is an obstacle to peace in the region amid the growing crisis in Gaza. Johnson said Wednesday that he had a lengthy conversation with the prime minister and reiterated to him that the House Republicans' strong support for Israel in their efforts there. To round out the news section, we have a couple of news briefs. Impeachment probe. House Republicans filed a lawsuit Thursday seeking to force two Justice Department lawyers to testify about the criminal investigation of President Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, as part of an impeachment inquiry that has produced no hard evidence of presidential wrongdoing. On Trump, New York prosecutors urged a judge on Thursday to start Donald Trump's hush money criminal trial on April 15th, saying the defense's calls for further delays or dismissal of the case because of a last-minute evidence dump were a red herring. On immigration, U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said Thursday that a Texas law giving state authorities the power to arrest and deport migrants who entered the U.S. illegally is unconstitutional. The law is on hold for now. From Ukraine, Russia fired 31 missiles at the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, before dawn Thursday. Air defenses shot down all missiles, but falling wreckage injured 13 people, officials said. Capitol riot. Jeffrey Sable, 54, of Colorado, who helped other rioters drag a police officer into a mob storming the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, was sentenced Thursday to more than 5 years in prison in the riot. Menendez. U.S. Senator Bob Menendez of New Jersey said Thursday he will not run in the Democratic primary as he faces federal charges in an alleged bribery scheme, but left open the possibility that he would run as an independent if exonerated. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 22nd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, in Des Moines. I'm Eve from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 515-243-6833. Again, 515-243-6833. There are no obituaries today, so we will be moving on to the sports section. On the men's NCAA tournament, Oakland delivers the first true shock. Reporting from Pittsburgh, Jack Gulk made 10 three-pointers, and 14th-seeded Oakland delivered the first true shock of this year's March Madness, beating 3rd-seeded Kentucky 80-76 in the first round of the NCAA tournament on Thursday night. The Grizzlies, with a record of 24-11, sent the Wildcats 23-10 to another early March exit behind Gulk, a graduate transfer who finished with 32 points and some late shot-making by his teammates. Trey Townsend had 17 points for the Horizon League champions. DQ Cole added 12, including a three from the corner with 28 seconds left that gave Grizzlies a 4-point lead. Antonio Reeves led Kentucky with 27 points. Trey Mitchell added 14, and Rob Dillingham scored 10. But the Wildcats and their roster, stacked with NBA prospects, spent most of their night trying and failing to chase down Gulk. The 6'3" guard, who came to the Grizzlies this season after playing for Division II Hillsdale College, made 10 of 20 three-point attempts, 7 in the first half. His only other points came after he was fouled while attempting a 3. The photo accompanying the story is of Oakland's Jack Gulk shooting a 3-pointer over Kentucky's Rob Dillingham during the NCAA tournament first-round game on Thursday in Pittsburgh. In the East, 11th-seeded Duquesne scored 71 points over 6th-seeded BYU with 67. Dede Grant scored 19 points, and the Dukes, with a record of 25-11, kept the retiring coach Keith Dambrit working a little bit longer with a victory over the Cougars, who had a record of 23-11. The Atlantic 10 tournament champs celebrated their return to the tourney after 47 years with their first win there since 1969. Jackson Robinson had 25 points for BYU. Second-seeded Iowa State triumphed over 15th-seeded South Dakota 82-65. Milan Momcilovic had 19 points. Taman Lipsy added 17 with 7 assists. And the Cyclones, with a record of 28-7, beat the Jackrabbits with a record of 22-13 to advance. Big 12 tourney MVP Keshawn Gilbert added 15 points for Iowa State, which avenged a first-round loss to Pittsburgh in last year's tournament. Third-seeded Illinois beat 14th-seeded Morehead State 85-69. Marcus Domask posted the tournament's first triple-double since 2019. Terrence Shannon scored 26 points, helping the Fighting Illini pull away from the Eagles in the opening round. Domask had 12 points, 11 rebounds, and 10 assists with his first career triple-double. Seventh-seeded Washington State beat 10th-seeded Drake 66-61. Isaiah Watts' first three-pointer in the three games gave the Cougars a lead with 151 left, and Washington State held off the Bulldogs. In the West, Michigan State, 8th-seeded, triumphed over 9th-seeded Mississippi State 69-51. Tyson Walker scored 19 points, and coach Tom Izzo picked up his 20th win in the first round as his Spartans beat the Rebels. Michigan State improved to 26 in March Madness openers under Izzo, who's making his 26th straight tournament appearance, a D1 record for a coach at one school. Second-seeded Arizona triumphed over 15th-seeded Long Beach State 85-65. The Wildcats scored 16 straight points over a 5-minute stretch to pull away from the Beach for a first-round victory that ended coach Dan Monson's tenure at Long Beach State. First-seeded North Carolina beat 16th-seeded Wagner 90-72. Armando Bacot had 20 points and 15 rebounds, and the Tar Heels advanced to the second round with a victory over the Seahawks. Jalen Withers had a season-high 16 points and matched his best rebounding work with 10 boards. RJ Davis added 17 of his 22 points after halftime. 7th-seeded Dayton triumphed over 10th-seeded Nevada 63-60. Daron Holmes II and the Flyers staged a huge March Madness rally, closing with a 24-4 run to erase a 17-point deficit and beat the Wolfpack. Holmes, the Atlantic 10 Player of the Year, finished with 18 points. In the Midwest, 3rd-seeded Creighton beat 14th-seeded Akron 77-60. Ryan Kalkbrenner scored 63 points, and Trey Alexander had 19 as the Blue Jays, who came within seconds of making the Final Four a year ago, opened this year's tournament with a win over the Zips. Akron's Enrique Freeman finished with 21 points and 14 boards for his 31st double-double, tying him with Navy great David Robinson for the single NCAA record. 7th-seeded Texas triumphed over number 10 Colorado State. Mark Obmus and Dylan Dissou each scored 12 points, and the Longhorns held the Rams to 11 points in the first half, en route to a first-round victory. 11th seeded Oregon beats 6th seeded South Carolina 87-73. Jermaine Cousinard scored a career-high 40 points to haunt his former school, leading the Ducks past the Gamecocks in their tournament opener. Cousinard spent 3 years at South Carolina before transferring. 5th-seeded Gonzaga beat 12th-seeded McNeese State 86-65. Graham Ike scored 16 points, and Anton Watson added 13 to power the Bulldogs past the Cowboys in the first round. Gonzaga spoiled McNeese State's trip to the NCAA tournament in 22 years. 2nd-seeded Tennessee beat 15th-seeded St. Peter's 83-49. Dalton Necht scored 23 points, and the Volunteers shot 64% in the first half to build a huge lead before beating the Peacocks in the first round of the tourney. 4th-seeded Kansas beat 13th-seeded Samford 93-89. KJ Adams Jr. scored 20 points, and the Jayhawks survived an upset bid by the Bulldogs. Samford's Jermaine Marshall missed a three-pointer to tie with 5 seconds left. 14th-seeded Oakland beat 3rd-seeded Kentucky. Jack Gulk made a 10 three-pointers, and the Grizzlies delivered the first true shock of this year's March Madness, beating the Wildcats in the opening round. The graduate transfer finished with 32 points. 11th-seeded North Carolina State had 80 points over 6th-seeded Texas Tech with 67. Ben Middlebrook scored a career-high 21 points, and the Wolfpack surged past the Red Raiders in the opening round. Up next from sports, an interpreter scandal rattles the Dodgers. From Seoul, South Korea. The camera shot of the dugout looked reminiscent of so many before. Shohei Ohtani approaching his longtime interpreter and close friend Ippei Mizuhara. The two exchanging a few words while gazing out at the field. Each of them cracking a smile and sharing a laugh, as if no major scandal was bubbling behind the scenes. These were the images that flashed across Sportsnet's LA broadcast in the 9th inning of the Dodgers' opening day win on Wednesday. A seemingly friendly interaction between Ohtani and Mizuhara at the end of Ohtani's victorious regular season debut with the team. Only everything was not okay. By the next morning, Ohtani's relationship with Mizuhara had permanently been stained. As the Los Angeles Times first reported, representatives of Ohtani accused his interpreter of engaging in a massive theft of the two-way star's funds, with millions of dollars of Ohtani's money allegedly used to pay off gambling debts Mizuhara owed to a bookmaker. Many within the Dodgers organization seem shocked by the whiplash turn of events during the past 24 hours and were hesitant to speak about the issue that immediately sparked intense social media speculation. "I hope show is good," Mookie Betts said when asked about the situation following Thursday's 15-11 loss to the Padres. But at the end of the day, you have to make sure we can take care of your job. Like I said, no matter what cards were dealt, you have to go and play them. The story came to light after Ohtani's name surfaced in a federal investigation into Orange County resident Matthew Bauer, an alleged illegal bookmaker who was the target of a federal investigation. Mizuhara, who has been Ohtani's personal interpreter throughout his MLB career and has known the 29-year-old since Ohtani's playing days in Japan's Nippon Professional Baseball League almost a decade ago, was accused of theft in a statement by West Hollywood law firm Burke Brettler, who represents Ohtani. In the course of responding to recent media inquiries, we discovered that Shohei has been the victim of a massive theft. We are turning the matter over to the authorities, the statement read. Thursday morning local time in South Korea, where the Dodgers are opening their season with an international series against the San Diego Padres, the Dodgers announced Mizuhara had been fired. "The Dodgers are aware of media reports and are gathering information," the team said in a statement. The team can confirm that the interpreter Ippei Mizuhara has been terminated. The team has no further comment at this time. Neither Mizuhara, Ohtani, nor Bauer have been charged with any crimes. None of the bets in question are known to have involved baseball games, and no one has alleged Ohtani to have placed any bets himself. Prior to the Dodgers' series finale in Seoul on Thursday, manager Dave Roberts declined multiple times to comment on details of the situation. Ohtani, who went 1-for-5 with an RBI as the team's designated hitter, also refused to address the situation following Thursday's game. Two public relations officials stood guard in front of his locker when he walked into the clubhouse. One of them then escorted Ohtani out of the room past a horde of media members. While Ohtani and Mizuwara appeared to be copacetic on the field Wednesday night, details of the scandal emerged in the Dodgers clubhouse postgame. As ESPN first reported, Mizuwara addressed the team following the 5-2 win over the San Diego Padres, according to people with knowledge of the situation not authorized to discuss it publicly. Mizuwara told the team a news story would soon be coming out detailing the situation, but he gave no indication of his alleged theft nor any impending departure from the team. Instead, according to people with knowledge of the situation not authorized to speak publicly, Mizuwara offered a story similar to the one he told ESPN on record Tuesday. Mizuwara claimed that he asked Ohtani last year to pay off his gambling debt, ESPN reported, and that while Ohtani was unhappy with Mizuwara, the two-time MVP agreed. Per Mizuwara's account, Ohtani then used his computer to send wire transfers to an associate of Bauer's, the alleged bookmaker at the center of federal investigation. Ohtani said he would help me out, Mizuwara told ESPN, to make sure I never do this again. By Thursday morning, Seoul, however, the story had changed. Ohtani's representatives made their accusations about Mizuwara's involvement in the massive theft, leading to his immediate firing from the team. Mizuwara was an employee of the Dodgers, just as he had been of the Angels during Ohtani's tenure with that team. Today, with Ask Amy, a solo walker is creeped out by man on trail. Accompanying this photo is a photo... Accompanying this column is a photo of Amy Dickinson, who writes the column in response to the questions. Dear Amy, most mornings, I walk by myself on a forested walking trail. Like most women, I keep a special eye out for my safety, regularly checking over my shoulder. Recently, one man, in his late 40s, has started appearing on my walks. At first, he seemed okay, so I said hello back after he greeted me. But very quickly, I started to get what can only be described as creep vibes, based on the way he was looking at me, the way he'd try to engage me in conversation, as opposed to a simple hello, the way he'd show up on the more secluded parts of the track I walk and seem to be waiting for me. I stopped saying hello because I'm not interested and I didn't want him to get a hint. I stopped saying hello because I wanted him to get the hint. I'm not interested, so leave me alone. And yet he keeps persisting. His behavior's getting weirder. I'm changing the time I walk so I won't run into him. But I want to know what the socially acceptable situation is in these situations. Women seem conditioned to think that we must be friendly, but I don't buy it. And while I want to expressly tell this man to get lost, I don't know what to say in a way that doesn't engender a dangerous response. What if he's a deranged stalker? What if he's deluded himself into thinking that my not saying hello is a signal for interest? I'm worried that's the level of what I'm dealing with. What would you do, solitary walker? Dear solitary, the first thing I would do is find another place and time to walk. You've done that. I would also notify whatever entity is in charge of this trail. Other people might have reported similar concerns. I would also consider walking with another person and or carrying a bottle of protection spray. Next, I would override that inner voice about what might be socially acceptable and focus completely on self-protection. I would also reread The Gift of Fear, Survival Signals That Protect Us from Violence, published in 2021 by Back Bay Books. This book is author Gavin DeBecker's own gift to the people, women especially, in instructing us to pay very close attention to our body's signals for when we are in danger and to act on those instincts. Women have been socialized to be polite and even to ignore their own instincts to flee in order to make a stranger comfortable. My suggestions might seem like a serious overreaction to what others might believe is nothing more than an annoyance, but you should never disregard your own instincts. This is the gift of your own fear. And this fear, concern, and caution is legitimate. Dear Amy, Don't you ever read the comments that run underneath your column on that newspaper's website? If you did, you'd gain a lot of wisdom, as well as an opportunity to correct your mistakes. Online reader. Dear reader, my column appears in around 150 newspapers and online sites. I agree that commenters have a lot of wisdom to share, but I think it's best for them and me if I let them exchange ideas without my interference. Readers who have a bone to pick can and do email their thoughts to me. You can email Amy Dickinson at askamy@amydickinson.com. Today in history. Today's highlight, on March 22, 2019, former President Jimmy Carter became the longest-living chief executive in American history. At 94 years and 172 days, he exceeded the lifespan of the late former President George H.W. Bush. On this date, in 1765, the British Parliament passed the Stamp Act to raise money from the American colonies, which fiercely resisted the tax. The act was repealed a year later. In 1882, President Chester A. Arthur signed a measure outlawing polygamy. In 1894, hockey's first Stanley Cup championship was played. Home team Montreal Hockey Club defeated Ottawa Hockey Club 3-1. In 1941, the Grand Coulee Hydroelectric Dam in Washington State officially went into operation. In 1945, the Arab League was formed with the adoption of a charter in Cairo, Egypt. In 1963, the Beatles' debut album, Please Please Me, was released in the United Kingdom. In 1978, Carl Wallenda, the 73-year-old patriarch of the Flying Wallendas High Wire Act, fell to his death while attempting to walk a cable strung between two hotel towers in San Juan, Puerto Rico. In 1988, Congress overrode President Ronald Reagan's veto of the Civil Rights Restoration Act. In 1993, Intel Corp. unveiled the original Pentium computer chip. In 1997, Tara Lipinski, at the age of 14 years and 10 months, became the youngest ladies' world figure skating champion in Lausanne, Switzerland. In 2010, Google Inc. stopped censoring the internet for China by shifting its search engine off the mainland to Hong Kong. In 2012, coroner's officials ruled singer Whitney Houston died by drowning, but that heart disease and cocaine were contributing factors. In 2017, a knife-wielding man plowed a car into pedestrians on London's Westminster Bridge, killing 4 people, and then stabbed an armed police officer to death inside the gates of Parliament before being shot by authorities. In 2020, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo ordered all non-essential businesses in the state to close and non-essential workers to stay home. Kentucky Republican Rand Paul became the first member of the U.S. Senate to report testing positive for coronavirus. Next up, we have toys and beds for dog teething. The photo is of a dog who looks like he's very much in trouble after tearing up what seems to be a toy or a pillow. There's stuffing all over the floor. The destructive phase is simply a dog's teething phase, writes Kathy M. Rosenthal, the author of this piece. Dear Kathy, we adopted our now 10-month-old pit mix from a shelter in Texas when she was 4 months old. She is the sweetest girl, incredibly smart, but with a lot of energy. Someone is almost always home, so she's rarely crated during the day and has a large gated area of the house to roam freely. Additionally, she's walked multiple times a day. Our main issue is that she's a chewer and will grab anything and everything, ripping it to shreds. Paper, cups, toys, you name it. We're currently enrolled in a series of training classes, focusing on commands like leave it and drop it. However, the challenge remains that she chews and shreds any bed we give her. She stops when corrected, she often returns to destroying it. Is there any solution, even an indestructible bed that could work for her? From Kathleen, from Neskenset, New York. Dear Kathleen, these days, there are several dog beds marketed as indestructible, probably with varying degrees of success depending on the chewer. I don't generally recommend specific products, but I recommend you check out Gorilla Dog Beds Ballistic Orthopedic Bed. It comes with a 125-day chew-proof warranty, which should be sufficient to get you through your puppy's destructive phase. The destructive phase is simply a dog's teething phase. They need to chew, so consider investing in indestructible dog toys to provide relief for her teething gums. While it's common for pets to tear up and shred things as puppies, rest assured it's temporary and she will outgrow it if you are consistent with her training. Teaching her commands like leave it and drop it will help her learn what's acceptable and not acceptable to chew. Always reward her with a treat or an indestructible toy immediately after she obeys this command to reinforce positive behavior. Also, it's crucial to pet-proof your home and keep items that you don't want her to tear up out of her reach. Please don't lose hope. With patience, vigilance, and providing appropriate toys and consistent training, you can help your sweet girl to become well-behaved and curb those destructive puppy tendencies. Dear Kathy, many years ago, my nephew had a Rottweiler. He was the biggest baby. He always sat on my feet, so I would pet him when visiting. He was good at protecting my nephew and his wife if he thought there was a threat, which wasn't often. Well, something changed. After a few years, the dog began growling and snarling whenever my nephew approached him, even during feeding times. With plans for starting a family, this behavior became a significant concern. They decided to enlist the help of a trainer to address the dog's protective tendencies around food. I can't recall the exact duration, but the training effectively resolved the issue. My nephew could peacefully sit next to the dog while he ate without any signs of aggression, a behavior that continued until the dog passed away years later. Hiring that trainer is worth every penny they spent. I want to pass this along so people see the benefit of a trainer before they are sued for any unpleasant occurrences caused by their dog. Liz, from Newington, Connecticut. Dear Liz, I'm glad to hear that your family took proactive steps to address their dog's behavior before introducing a baby into the household. I would like to add some more advice on pets and babies. It's crucial to not leave a child under 8 years old unsupervised with a dog, even the family dog. Young children may inadvertently provoke a reaction from the dog by grabbing or startling them. By 8 years old, most children have learned sufficient self-control and understanding on how to behave around dogs, especially if their parents have been careful to teach them. Even at 8 years old, though, I remained vigilant when my son had friends over to play. I also recommend providing dogs with their own space, such as kennel training, to give them a place to retreat when they've had enough of energetic activities. Kathy M. Rosenthal is an author and pet expert. Email her at kathy@petpundit.com. You can include your name, city, and state. You can also follow her at Kathy M. Rosenthal. This movie review from Katie Walsh calls the movie Immaculate a well-conceived horror flick, a modern take on religious themes. The photo accompanying this story is of Sydney Sweeney starring in Immaculate. She's wearing a very long see-through veil held up by nuns. Immaculate is available in English and Italian with English subtitles. The author of this piece gives the movie a 3 out of 4. It's rated R for strong and bloody violent content, grisly images, nudity, and some language. It's 1 hour 29 minutes long and can be seen in theaters. Blood-soaked and candlelit, Michael Mohan's Immaculate disabuses the notion that any conception is ever without sin. Starring Sydney Sweeney, who also produced the film, this cheeky, freaky, lusciously designed horror movie presents as a giallo nunsploitation riff, but the script by Andrew Lobel is so much more than Rosemary's Baby than it is the devil's. Still, Mohan wants Immaculate to be an exploitation flick, and it is an exploitation flick, which means he's adorned Lobel's script in texture, atmosphere, and viscera, taking the genre seriously while also applying an ironic wit. He skews towards modern horror filmmaking, but as the references and deep film knowledge make Immaculate feel more like a long-lost video dredged out of an obscure archive. Sweeney stars as Sister Cecilia, a doe-eyed and docile devotee from Detroit who has traveled to Italy at the behest of a Father Tedeschi, played by Alvaro Morte, take her vows at a secluded convent where she will care for elderly nuns. Soon, shockingly, she's exhibiting pregnancy symptoms, her womb thrumming with a whooshing heartbeat under a sonogram machine. Her spontaneous conception is seen as a miracle, but the resurrection of God. She has no choice but to carry this pregnancy to term, surrounded by jealous novitiates, senile nuns, and controlling male leadership in a sect of the sisterhood who wears crimson shrouds over their faces. It's something of a wonder to watch Sweeney as she undertakes Sister Cecilia's journey, transforming from a meek naif into something unexpected and wild, her pious discipline falling away with every indignity. If this film builds up to an absolutely feral climax, we do believe in her, perhaps most of all in the film's final jaw-dropping moments. While Sweeney tackles Cecilia's journey, her longtime collaborator Mohan directs the ever-loving hell out of Lobel's script, drenching every frame in color, light, and shadow, sending the cinematographer's camera swooping around the characters, into coffins and down dark hallways. There's an over-reliance on jump scares, which are only intermittently effective because as audience members, we're trained to expect them and tire easily if they don't pay off. However, these fade to the background as the film evolves into a more effectively suspenseful filmmaking, as Mohan operationalized darkness and light to intriguing ends. It's goopy, gross, fun, if not entirely terrifying, and there's a weak link. It's a screenplay which toys with deeper social and sexual themes, but skims along the surface and leaves loose ends unfinished. Still, if some of the mysterious elements exist merely to add mood and tone, it's worth it. If certain aspects of the convent's culture go unexplored, it's because Sister Cecilia hasn't the time or the language skills to figure it out, and Mohan keeps us locked into her perspective and subjective experiences of this place as an outsider. This strange cult is as mysterious to us as it is to her, as it would be in any good folk horror film. All these references, which include but are not limited to Giallo, Hammer Horror, Frankenstein, The Omen, The Wicker Man, and even a shade of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, ultimately coalesce during the bravura climax, which flips the script on Rosemary's Baby, allowing for a kind of inevitable agency that finally drags Immaculate into a truly modern conception. In that moment, any and all qualms fall away as the only appropriate reaction can be bravo. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for March 22nd. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 5 p.m. I'm Eve from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the blind and print disabled.